You did. Or I would have moved on without it. Sorry, this computer, the internet's lagging a little bit. It'll catch up. But, you know, nothing in here is by mistake. I really don't understand, because you will see the first verse, 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 1. Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace and the temple of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. You know, you can look at all kinds of commentaries on it. Just seems like a weird note, because to me, all throughout the Bible, Egypt is a symbol of the world, right? So the Israelites were captive in the world. We're captive in the world. Coming out of Egypt is the Lord releasing you from that bondage. So obviously then for the kings of Israel, God said, don't multiply to yourself wives. Israel in general was not supposed to marry outside of Israel. So it seems like a lot of mistakes going on. And then when he says he brought her to the city of David, which would be Bethlehem, the house of bread, so he brought the world into the house of bread. I can understand it, because we all know that some Solomon's life, that it didn't end well for him. Or maybe it did end well, but there was a really, really bad part in it. But the second verse is a little weird, or the third verse, I should say. So, the people, however, were still sacrificing in the high places because the temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. So, basically what you have was the tabernacle, and people weren't traveling all the way to the tabernacle to offer sacrifices, and all the religions around, and even got incorporated into Judaism a little bit, in that everybody wanted to sacrifice in the high places. That was thought to be where you were closest to the gods, if you will, and all the other religions and worship of all the other gods. And it kind of got pulled into Judaism a little bit at this point. And Israel were sacrificing, maybe in a good way, to Jehovah, but they were doing it in the high places. Which, if the temple is built on a saddleback, it is not the highest point around. And that's kind of the point of where the temple was built, was it wasn't a high place to offer sacrifice. All right, so...
And technically, it was against the wall, because they were only supposed to sacrifice in one place.
Right. So, it was... So, it's kind of a weird start here, because then verse 3 says, Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the instructions given him by his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burnt incense on the high places. So, it's kind of a juxtaposition, if you will, that it says he showed his love for the Lord and all this stuff, but he did this. So, so that's kind of Solomon's life, in a nutshell. It's always... He did this good, but he did this. So there's always that, and, you know, for all of us, I'm sure that's all of our own lives. So the king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices for what was the most important high place, and Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on the altar. And at Gibeah, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said, ask for whatever you want me to give you. And Solomon answered, you have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in your heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king in the place of my father David, but I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and distinguish between right and wrong, for who is able to govern this great people of you? And the really awesome part of that bit is verse 10. It says, and the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So what could be, that's basically well done, good and faithful servant, is in a nutshell. So here's, you know, he's very humble. He was, I think they say between 15 and 18 when he took the throne. So he is a very, very young guy. And hopefully we don't get an awesome insight into it. But, you know, David failed his family in a lot of ways. But it seems like it appeared that he passed some things on to Solomon, that they had a relationship, that he passed some things on to him. Verse 11. So God said to him, since you have asked for this and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there be. That's a pretty awesome thing to hear. I guess the hard part then would be to try to keep your ego under a check when, you know, the God that created everything comes to you and says, hey, man, I'm going to make you awesome, and there's going to be nobody like you. So that's a pretty smart dude. So verse 13, sorry, it's, for some reason the internet's kind of lagging the router, so I'm sorry, so I'll just go on. So verse 13, I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days. Here's the caveat. And if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. So, it's kind of interesting comparing verse 14 to verse 1, because it looks like he's already stepped in a bear trap. So, it's kind of weird how this might not be in chronological order, everything here. But for some reason, the Holy Spirit pointed out he made a mistake right off the bat. But at this point, it looks like God's just ignoring that. He's just, like, seeing him for what he can be, not the mistakes he's made. So verse 15, and Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. Then he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and offered up burnt offerings and peace offerings and made a feast for all his servants. So, everything seems to be going good. He's got this. So now we're going to get an example of, it's really, really an interesting example of this discernment that the Lord has given him. No speaking in Sunday school. No, go ahead.
So I think it's important to realize what was said at the beginning when it says, Solomon loved the Lord. And I think because, and then he said, then he married us, and then he sacrificed the high places. But what we find out is, when he's doing it because out of a heart and he loves the Lord, even though it's wrong, which I think we do all the time, we do things that we love the Lord and that might not be right or what we think are okay or brought in from the world, whatever. But it's the goodness that God that reveals himself to him, that gives him. So it's his goodness that leads him to repentance, because right afterwards he's in Jerusalem. He didn't have to point out his sin. He didn't have to point out anything to him. All he had to do is reveal his goodness and character to him and speak to him. And then Solomon did what was right. And I think that's important for us to keep in mind, that we love the Lord, we don't do things right, but it's not his beating you down, it's him revealing himself to you and showing you his mercy that brings you to a place of true worship.
Well, and I think the New Testament revelation of that is the Hall of Faith in Hebrews. If you go through those people's lives that are actually listed as these great, you know, men of faith, a lot of them failed miserably. And I think that offers all of us hope that, you know, when it's come to the end, when the Lord looks down on you, you're not going to have a defense for anything that you did when you stand before God. It's your belief in Jesus and who he sees in him, in you, as an imager of him, that's your salvation. You are not your salvation. And there's nothing you can do to change that. And that's what he's kind of, that's what that Hall of Faith to me says. When the time comes, look, I'm not going to see all that. I see you for what I created you to be and all this cool stuff you did, and you believed. You made a lot of mistakes, but you believed. And that's what was important. And, I mean, obviously believed in the right thing, because I think, especially in our society and what you're seeing today with this age of deceit, that people believe in a lot of things doesn't necessarily make it true. So we have to be on our guard for that. So, verse 16. So then two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. I just kind of find that interesting just in that verse, that two prostitutes were able to access the king. I mean, that's pretty impressive. That already shows to me a little humility that he's ready to speak to anybody that has a problem. Here he's sitting in this, I guess at this role he's playing the judge, if you will, literally the judge, not the judge in the book of Judges kind of thing. So, but he's willing to sit down and talk to everybody. So one woman said, "Oh my Lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. Then on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth. And we were alone. There was no one else with us in the house. Only we two were in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she'd lie on him." I'm assuming, you know, weaning the baby and nursing the baby. I mean, nursing the baby, that somehow she rolled over in the night and, you know, suffocated him. "And she arose at midnight and took my son from beside me while your servant slept, and laid him at her breast, and laid her dead son at my breast. When I arose in the morning to nurse the child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, behold, he was not the child that I had born." So obviously she's expressing the fact that she believes the children were switched, the babies. "But the other woman said, 'No, the living child is mine and the dead child is yours.' The first said, 'No, the dead child is yours and the living child is mine.' Thus they spoke before the king." So this is almost like an episode of Jerry Springer, right in front of the king. "Then the king says, 'This one says, this is my son that is alive and your son is dead. And the other says, no, but your son is dead and my son is alive.'" So this is a pretty interesting way to solve this problem. I mean, we all kind of know the story looking at it, but you got, in real life, this had to be a really interesting. So the king says, "Bring me a sword." So a sword was brought before the king. And the king said, "Divide the living child in two and give one half to one and a half to the other." Then the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because her heart yearned for her son, "Oh, my Lord, give her the living child and by no means put him to death." But the other said, "He shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide him." So it's a pretty slick way of getting, knowing a mother's love for her child would be, "I'd rather see him live with somebody else than killed." Whereas the mother that doesn't have that, the woman that doesn't have that attachment to that child would say, "I don't care. You know, her son should die because mine's dead, basically. I don't want her to be happy either." It's kind of the world in a nutshell. And the king answered and said, give the living child to the first woman and by no means put him to death. She is his mother. And all Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king, because they perceived that the wisdom of God was with him to do justice. So it just, it's a really neat story. It's really a smart play by him, a way to expose what looked like a kind of a deadlock, she said, she said kind of thing, that he exposed that. But I think it's also, it's really cool that the kingdom what's here, that God was in him to do justice. That as human beings, that's one of our needs. It's one of what we look for, is to have leadership that does justly. And that's why leadership was part of the reason they were established, to do justice. You know, and as we see in our country, that's just a tough, you know, at least in my opinion, we don't see much of that anymore. And just, there's nothing worse than a corrupt judiciary system that, you know, growing up, we always made fun of, you know, the Russians and how people were in Cuba or whatever. And now, you know, to me, it looks like we're just bad, if not worse. So it's a really, really sad thing to watch a country slide down that path. But, you know, it's all we can do is stay on our knees and pray about it and, you know, what it is. But it really shows you that the kingdom kind of rejoiced because they knew they had a just king, that makes a big difference in the health of a nation. That's my soapbox on that one. Anybody have any comments before we go on? Anything else? We'll go back and look at the monster on the mountain.
The only thing I was going to interject earlier was that the mother had 3 days to know its baby, to know her baby also. You know, like, it wasn't like they were red born, and then it's like, I'm not sure if that's mine. You know, this is she knew her baby.
Yeah, I would think that would be a pretty, that mom, you know, never been a mother, thank goodness, but the world tells me I could have been one, you know, moms know their babies, like, the most intimate relationship, you know, as a newborn, it depends on your mom for everything, you know, your very sustenance. So, yeah, that's interesting. There's probably a bigger lesson in that about, you know, somewhere in there, there's a sermon. If someone wants to preach on to dig into that.
The sword is making division.
Yes. The Lord, you know, the Word of God is a two-edged sword. There you go. So, 1 Kings chapter 4. King Solomon was over all Israel, which is kind of important because you remember it was 12 tribes and it was kind of been a mess throughout all this. So, it looks like it's finally coalesced into an actual country, if you will, kingdom. This is going to be, I don't know what to go through this. I'll go through and read it because obviously it was put here for a reason and we should read it. I don't know, other than to say that Solomon, a good leader, is willing to put, doesn't look like he micromanages. Like he puts people in positions and let them do their job. So, I mean, that might be what I get out of here, but I really... All right, so verse 2. And these were his high officials. And forgive me for the names. If anybody wants to read, feel free. Azariah, the son of Zadok, was the priest. Eliphaz and Eha, the sons of Shishah, were secretaries. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Elud, was recorder. And I think that was a pretty big job. You know, we take it for granted in our society that everybody knows how to read and write. That was agrarian society. Only the elite class knew how to read and write. That's why the law was to be read every year to the people, because it wasn't like everybody had a copy of the, you know, the five books of Moses in their house. Nobody, only certain people could read and write, and that class was the priest. And that's why they were to read, to remind people of the laws, because they couldn't just read them every day on themselves. Like we have the privilege of our, and I know for myself, sometimes I forget that. You just think, you just take it for granted. You know, we have Bibles in our living room, Bibles in our car, Bibles, you know, all over the place, and we just kind of take it for granted where...
Well, this man's the reason why we have what we have.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I find it very funny because I cannot remember. These kids cannot read in cursive. Mm-hmm. And I write notes to the next group. We can't read it in Shirley.
I have heard of whole groups of kids that cannot read an analog clock.
Coming down.
So, what is that?
It's the digital age. So, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the army. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. Azariah, the son of Nathan, was over the officers, and Zabud, the son of Nathan, was a priest and king's friend. So, I guess the other thing I should point out here, I kind of made light of, but some of this, when you start doing historical things in the Bible, you can look back and find that's how you trace lineages and stuff like that, and you have these lists of names sometimes that helps put that together and give it a time frame. And all those, so all this is here for a reason. It's just, it's a little tough to read the names because they're, you know, trying to be interpreted or put into English. And I'm not even good with English sometimes. Ashar was in charge of the palace, and Adoram, the son of Abda, was in charge of the forced labor. So that had to be an interesting job. So basically, the forced labor was all the non-Jews that were in. Remember all the places that David conquered, he said he made them slaves. So that's basically, this guy's in charge of all those people. So Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel who provided food for the king and his household. Each man made a provision for 1 month a year. So basically what, and I have a map I'll show you, that divided the country up into 12. And it wasn't by tribes, which was a pretty smart play because you know how that would have led to this tribe's doing more than this tribe. And this. So he kind of broke down the tribal barriers a little bit. And basically each sector of the 12 would provide a month's worth of things. So you would have to take the, you know, again, agrarian society. You would have to take your harvest and you would provide 1 month your food went to the storehouse, went to the, you know, IRS, if you will, and you basically paid your taxes 1/12 of the year. So that worked around that everybody paid their taxes. That's how they did. So Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel, provided food for the king and his household. Each man had to make provisions for 1 month a year. These were their names, Ben-Hur. We like that movie, right? So now you know what he ended up doing at the end of the movie. Was in the hill country of Ephraim. Sorry, that's... Ben-Decker in Machaz, Shalbin in Beth Shemesh, and Ellen Beth Hanan.
I'm going to clap for you.
Ben Hested in Aruba. To him belong Sokloth and all the land of Hefer. Ben Abedad in all Naphtal Dor. He had Tapath, the daughter of Solomon, as his wife. So here's the Solomon's son-in-law's got a spot. Benai, the son of Alud in Tanakh. Megiddo, and all Beth-Shin, and beside Sebeth, below Jezreel, and from Beth-Shin to Abel-Meroleh, as far as the other side of Jokmeam. Ben-Gerber, in Ramoth-Gilead, he had the villages of Jar, the son of Manasseh, and which are in Gilead, and had the region of Argob, which is in Bashan, 60 great cities with walls and bronze bars. Ahibadad, son of Ido, in Menahem, Ahimaaz in Naphtali, he was taken Basemath, the daughter of Solomon, as his wife, so another son-in-law. Benai, son of Hishi, in Abner and Bechod, Jehoshaphat, the son of Peru, in Issachar, Shimei, the son of Eli, and Benjamin, and Gerber, the son of Uri, in the land of Gilead, in the country of Shinon, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan, and there was one governor who was governor over the land. So one guy was in charge. Anybody see anything interesting in that last little name, set of names there, in verse 19?
David's guy climbing the mountain.
That's one of the guys climbing the mountain right there. Og the king of that was Nephilim. These were so they had conquered the Nephilim, and now they were serving the kingdom. So I don't know if that comes back to bite them eventually. So other than it's there, we should read it. There's use for it and doing things, but there's probably some stuff in there if you could dig through it that would be useful. But I always thought that was really cool that Og, the king of Bashan, is in there.
That was also taking them back to their coming into the lake.
Right.
That wasn't the king, you know what I mean, of the time then. They're 400 some years back talking about.
Yeah.
That's still his lake, that lake.
I copied a map for you if it helps any. I don't know if you can. I didn't find any that were really, really. Some of it's a little bit of conjecture because the names have changed. Come on. Come on. Come on. You can do it, Waterboy. Well, sorry, but when it comes up eventually, it will show you that those divisions, if you're interested, and you know, I can give you the map if you want. There it is.
Ta-da!
Ta-da! So, that was the best I could do, surprisingly. Everybody's a little different, to be honest with you. That was the best one with, like, it had the mountains and the hill regions. You could see a little better. It's a little topographical. But as you can see, it's not divided up. It was a pretty smart play, I think. The bottom line was it wasn't divided up per the tribes. It was basically regions. So you didn't have, you know, this tribe saying this tribe isn't given their, because that was a lot of what went on in judges and stuff, and people were supposed to do stuff, and they wouldn't do it, and then next thing you know, they end up fighting each other. So there's that kind of thing. So I guess it was, you know, showing that Solomon was a good organizer and had laid out. It's going to be kind of interesting, and I'll save it for next week as far as let's see.
Chris, I have a question. You know, in the beginning it says, maybe I'm missing something, but it says he had 12, and Solomon had 12 governors over all Israel who provided for the king and his household. Each one made provision for 1 month of the year. I get that. But then you get back to the end of that whole chapter in your names, and it says, and of Og, king of Bashan, this is the last one that's mentioned,
mm-hmm.
He was the only governor who was in the land. What does that mean?
There was one guy that governed all 12, and I guess that guy answered to the king, almost like I kind of took it as a Joseph
yes.
thing back in Egypt. Remember when...
Yeah, first it says it's 12, and then it says it's 1.
Right.
So I was like, is he the one guy in a certain section of the land, or is he the one guy in charge of all the other
people? That's what I took it as, the kind of thing like, yeah, like Joseph, that there was 12 guys, but the king didn't feel like bothering with all 12 of them all the time.
Okay,
he put one guy, say, you deal with all them, and you come to me with the final answer.
One of the 12 also.
Right.
Okay, that's what I was like. One
and I think, I didn't put it in here. As I was going through that, some people made a big deal that they thought that Judah and parts of Jerusalem were excluded from the taxes. That might have led to, that might have been part of what's coming in the future. That they felt like they were unjustly being taxed when other people weren't. Again, you know, always a problem. So verse 20. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea, and they ate and drank and were happy. And they all lived happily ever after. Although it's a subtle hint there that it calls Judah and Israel. So it's already showing you a division. So Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms. Think about this when you got these people crying from the, you know, from the West Bank to the sea. But it says, he ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So basically from where Babylon was all the way down to Egypt, Solomon had charge of all that. So when you say from the river to the sea, they're talking about obviously the Jordan, but God's talking about the Euphrates, right? So it's kind of interesting. I thought that was interesting because it was in the news when I was looking at this. So Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 pleasure-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides steer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl, for he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tizpah to Gaza, all over all the kings of the west of the Euphrates, and he had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan to Beersheba, again, probably from, we would say, from Maine to California, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, which that's like saying a chicken in every pot. Basically, it's what everybody was, an agrarian society, so, you know, they ate fruits and, you know, made wine from the grapes, so that's basically saying everybody had what they needed. So, Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen, and those officers supplied provisions for King Solomon and for all who came to King Solomon's stable, each one in his month, that let nothing be lacking. Barley also and straw for horses and swift steeds they brought to the place where it was required, each according to his duty. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and the breadth of a mind like the sand of a seashore. So he was evidently really, really, I mean, I don't know if we can grasp how smart he was. Right? You know, you're always seeing things in a paper about how as humans now we only use like a third of our brains or something that... So maybe God, you know, gave him the capability to use all the stuff he doesn't, that we don't. For he was wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Hermon, Calcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. And he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. I mean, that's a pretty prolific writer. I mean, you got a lot of time on your hands when you can do that, and you're a deep thinker. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of the beasts and of the birds and the reptiles and the fish. And people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all the kings of the earth who had heard his wisdom. So, I'll give you real, we got 4 minutes, so I kind of, I thought this was, because I was looking at what it took. You remember going all the way back, God was going to provide them a king. He knew they were going to ask for a king. But God wanted to be their king. And one of the things that Samuel said, you know, you're going to kind of rue the day that you, because this king's going to want stuff and you're going to have to provide it. So just to get a feel for this. The daily consumption of provisions amounted to 30 cores of fine meal, sifted meal, and 60 cores of ordinary meal, 10 fattened oxen, 20 pasture oxen, which were brought directly from the pasture and slaughtered, and 100 sheep, besides different kinds of game, and later the name for the largest also, wait a minute, kinds of game, the later is the name for largest dry and also liquid measure of capacity, contained 10 ephahs or baths, according to the calculation made by Tennis. 15,300 cubic inches equals 1/7 of a shefel. So to go through all that, so the 90 cores would amount to 171 shefels, from which 28,000 pounds of bread could be baked. And if we reckon 2 pounds of bread for each person, there would be 14,000 people in Solomon's court. The consumption of flesh would be quite proportioned to that bread, for 10 fattened oxen, 20 oxen for the pasture, equals more than 21,000 pounds of meat. That is to say, 1.5 pounds for each person, assuming according to the statements of those who are acquainted with the matter, that is edible meat, a fat ox about 600 pounds, 400 pounds. The daily consumption of Solomon's court would not appear to be too great if, on the other hand, we compare it to the quality consumed in other oriental courts of ancient times. So, I can show you this, but it just shows you the extreme amount of, and to relate it to our day, as our bureaucracy becomes more and more bloated and more money are taken out of the economy in our pockets to feed that bloated bureaucracy. Don't think that it's something new. It's been going on for as long as man has tried to rule himself. So it's kind of interesting that they had geese, but I was it's just amazing how much they consumed and how much they pulled out of the economy, too. But it is what it is. Okay. And start next week, I don't know. Because I can look at this. I don't know if anybody uses it. I'll start if it comes up for going to next week. And that's where I got all that, is in the Keeley and Dish Biblical Commentary on the Old Testament, because I was trying to figure out how much all that stuff was. But, I mean, yeah, 14,000 people in his government, if you will. This is killing me. But anyway, so any questions, comments, anything that I know that really wasn't super duper. That's why I put the big monster in the front. But I don't know what you, like I said, I think that all the names are there. And yeah.
Question. In 31, when it talks about wiser than all these men, is there a lot known about these men?
I don't know, to be honest. I guess we could look that up. I could have
looked
that
up. I was just looking at a couple of them. It was like a magician, a musician. One was a musician, but it was talking about him being wise.
Well,
so,
because he wrote all those songs and psalms and proverbs and stuff, so I guess...
He knew about a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah. So, starting next week, I'll try to make it'll take a lot more pages to get through, but is that better with the words up there being a little bigger?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it'll just make more slides to go through, but I'll start. I guess, like I said, I'm sorry, my bad, because I can read off of this, so it doesn't look different to me, but I was looking up there a couple times. I was like, boy, that's awful small to be trying to. So, well, I'll do better as far as making the words. So.
Right. Thank you, Chris.
You're not fired.
You did really well on those names.
Oh. You guys can fire me anytime you want to.
We're voting for you. You're not voted off the island.
Not voted off the island, yeah. I still got my flame or whatever they do. I can honestly say I've never seen a minute of that show, so I still have those brain cells. All right, anybody, any other last minute comments?
It was 39. Who's the word used in Sarah?
And breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore. What does yours say?
There's largeness of heart.
Yeah,
mine
too.
Those are cool.
So yeah. Evidently, he was just really, really, God gave him, like, super duper mind
power. Bring you, like, other people, you get around dumb people.
Right, how you feel. That's where I used to work. They would always hire dumb people so the bosses felt smarter. All right, does anybody want to close this in prayer? Anybody volunteering? No, I can do it. I'll do it.